Welcome to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. In each episode, Andrew interviews industry leaders. We'll hear their real-time opinions on today's market, their background and unique career highlights, and guidance for newcomers into the industry. You can find this show at scholarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Now here's the host of Real Talk, Andrew Kirsch.
Episode 17 of Real Talk. Well, we are about 3 weeks away from ULA coming into effect in the city of LA. If you don't know ULA, it dramatically increases the transfer tax for all real estate sales within the city of LA. Anything over $5 million, add on another 4% transfer tax. Anything over $10 million, add another 5.5% transfer tax. That just reduces the value of real estate by 5.5%. So we were expecting to see a flood of transactional activity for closings to occur by March 31st to avoid this quote unquote mansion tax, although it applies to all real estate, whether it's residential or commercial. You know, we're seeing a lot of distress in the office market, particularly in downtown LA. Large office buildings and office product coming to market, selling at some prices, record prices, record low prices at $200 a foot or even less, just to trade by March 31st. We'll see if any of these occur. On this episode of Real Talk, we have Noah Hochman, the co-chief investment officer of True America. Noah is a good friend, and True America is a great client. And Noah was there at the beginning, about 10 years ago, with Bob Hart in the formation of True America. And they have become one of the largest owner-operators of multifamily, really throughout the country. As of now, in 2023, they own and operate approximately $18 billion of multifamily product. I hope you'll enjoy my conversation with Noah Hochman.
Hello there. Welcome to another episode of Real Talk. I am here with my good friend and client and mishpucha from our days in Israel, Noah Hochman, co-chief investment officer and head of capital markets of True America Multifamily. Noah, how you doing?
Andrew, good to be here. And thanks for finally inviting me to participate in what's been a transformative podcast for our industry. So,
yeah, I mean, look, not just the industry, but I think for society. And yeah, I'm glad that you're on the 2,593rd episode. We finally found a spot for you. So I appreciate it.
It's good. I begged you long enough. So I figured with all the fees we pay you, I would have gone on earlier, but apparently we're not your number one client anymore. So
always in my heart, Noah, always. So let's get right into it, Noah. I'm sure a lot of our listeners know about True America and have maybe even transacted with them. You guys are one of the most active multifamily owner operators, but for those that don't know who True America is, why don't you let them know who you are?
Sure, pleasure. So True America is a vertically integrated multifamily platform that has been focusing on what we call Class B workforce housing with a renovation and repositioning strategy. We launched the platform in 2013. We're actually going to have our 10-year anniversary here this June. And, what started with $10 million in working capital has grown into a $18 billion platform, 60,000 units that we own and manage. And, we are now, according to NMHC, as of last year, the 29th largest apartment owner, and call it the youngest group on that list. And so we're now active in 20 states, 25 MSAs, and have eight offices throughout the country with our headquarters here in Century City.
Yeah, I mean, gosh, I can't believe $18 billion assets under management. I specifically remember meeting Bob Hart for the first time, I think with you at a dinner briefly in an IMN conference, and you were considering, you know, your next move. And I want to talk about your history and different positions you held before True America and the rise of True America. But let's talk about where we sit today in 2023. It's an interesting market. It's completely different from, you know, 6 months ago, 8 months ago. And what is your view as to today's market? You know, the most common phrase when we went to NMHC a couple of weeks ago was simply there's no price discovery, or the bid ask spread is too wide. I mean, what is that what you're seeing, and what will it take for there to be a healthy amount of transactional volume? Nothing crazy like what we saw in 21 and early 22, but like a 2018 and 19 pre-COVID market.
Yeah. I think you'll have to see a more normalization of the debt markets, capital markets, or you'll need to see situations where owners are in a situation where they're forced to transact. I think the biggest challenge right now is there's kind of a, as I talk to my investors about, a tale of two cities. You know, the capital markets, I mean, everybody's reading the newspapers of all this interest rates, volatility, hard to get loans. The fundamentals of our business and residential housing in the U.S. continue to be strong. And, you know, with exceptions of some markets here or there, a lot of owners are still continuing to get operational growth, rent growth at their properties. And it's not the growth that they were getting 12 months ago, but it's enough growth where people are at the moment just willing to hang out until the world improves a little in the capital markets thing. So I think, you know, you're definitely hearing stories about borrowers that owners that, you know, got high leverage. They did bridge financing. People have insurance hedges that they need to renew. But at the moment, nobody is in a situation where, you know, they're forced to sell. So I think people are just hoping they can kind of grow themselves into a better value and better position before, you know, they're forced to do something with their current loan. So that's kind of, we're in this environment where the people that are selling, and we're sellers right now and a handful of deals, where we might have owned these things for 5-6 years and the cap rates are in the fives, and that's okay because we bought these deals, and, you know, 5-6 years ago for 5.5-6 caps, and we underwrote to sell them, you know, for, you know, 6.25. And even if we're selling them for 5.25 today, yeah, it's not the 3 cap it was 12 months ago, but, you know, was it really ever a 3 cap or should have been, you know, that's, you know, to be debated. So there are people that are sellers because we're taking profits. But I think most people are probably, hoping for better valuations and aren't forced to do anything at the moment. That was kind of a long answer to your question. So,
well, we can always edit your answers down to 30 seconds. No, it's good to have a complete answer, but let me follow up on you selling right now and why you're selling now versus if you take, you know, and I know every asset stands on its own and where you are, if it was a fund investment versus a joint venture investment, there's all different reasons, but
why do you choose to sell today? And maybe why didn't you want to sell 12 months ago? And why not wait for another 12 months? And I'm not asking you to speak specifically on one particular asset, but just sort of in general, the thought process behind selling in today's market.
I mean, there's no right answer. And certainly looking backwards to the end of 21 and early 22, I mean, we did sell a fair amount. Do I wish we sold more? Sure. And, you know, the challenge, you know, that we have in our business, which is both an investment manager model where we have a commingled institutional fund, but we also have a, you know, Rolodex of institutional LPs that we do joint ventures with that have various input on sales is, you know, I think a lot of, you know, we found that, you know, a lot of our partners, even though we were making recommendations to sell assets, you know, got a little intoxicated with all this rent growth and I think believed it was going to continue on forever. And I don't think people expected the world to move as quickly as it did and the markets to move as quickly as they did with rates this year. So that window closed. But why sell today versus 12 months from now? You know, will the environment be better? I don't know. Will it be worse? I don't know. And I think we don't, our view here is we don't try to time markets. Nobody's going to be able to time it perfectly. I still think there's deals that were at the end of our business plan. We have partners that have a lot of equity invested with us and in certain cases just wanted to reduce the exposure. And if you can take huge profits in doing that, why not? Nobody's going to penalize you for taking profits today and feel like you left money on the table 12 months from now. So, you know, I think our view is we're in probably at least for the next 12, 18 months and in a choppy environment, choppy world, where we'll probably bump around. And, you know, are values lower today than they were 9 months ago? Yes. Will they be lower in 6 months from now? Maybe, maybe not. Will they be higher again? I think our view is in 3 years from now, 5 years from now, 7 years from now, absolutely yes. So, you know, a lot of these assets that we own require new capital. And at a certain point, you just, if you've hit your business plan, you got to be disciplined sellers. And there is a market for multi, and that's the beauty of the property type is it is liquid. You can transact. There's a lot of capital on the sidelines. That's why cap rates continue to be lower than people think they should be. And
well, let's talk about the acquisition side. So we talked about the sales side. You know, you walk around at these conferences from the IMN conference to NMHC and other conferences where there's a lot of institutional capital. It doesn't seem like the joint venture partners that you have historically transacted with, they may say they're open for business, but they're really not open for business right now. What's your perspective? Are you seeing joint venture common equity wanting to transact with you guys right now?
Yes and no. I think when I look at my Rolodex of LPs, my observation is, yeah, I agree with you. A lot of them are window shopping. I think, you know, end of last summer, everybody were pencils down. I think the consensus was, you know, I was at PREA ULI at the end of last year. You know, November, December, people start looking at their pencils again. They hadn't quite picked it up. I still don't think they've really picked it up. But, you know, there are some of our LPs that need to put out capital. It's a smaller subset. So
yeah,
we are doing some transactions right now. But, you know, I feel like the situations need to be special and have a story to it. buying, right. You know, whereas I think 12 months ago where people were buying the market, right now people want a story and, you know, beyond better returns, that, you know, there has to be a special situation. A lot of what we've been doing in the past 3 or 6 months are what we call recapitalizations, or truly buying and selling our own deals. So we treat them like new acquisitions. I know you work on, you've been working on some of those. And so, you know, we have LPs that are in the market, but it's, everything's very selective right now. So,
yeah. Well, on that specific type of transaction where you're recapping them with a new equity partner, what is the thought process there versus selling it to a completely third party buyer in which you have no participation, versus being part of the buyer group?
Yeah. I think at the end of the day, our exiting LP, wants certainty of execution, and it's hard to get that in this market right now. For, you know, various reasons, you know, again, we have partners that need to exit things. In some cases, you know, we've ran a process, and at the end we had another LP that said, hey, do you have anything for us to look at? And we said, here, we're in this marketing process. We have a deal, you know, in Florida, and our new partner's like, I would buy that deal at that price. And, you know, at the end of the day, when you transact with your LPs long enough, everybody is friends with each other, and you know, they want to be good partners, and if they feel like they're getting a fair price, and there's been some price discovery, then, you know, people are happy to get certainty of close and sell to their own partner in those instances. So,
yeah. And, you know, traditionally, and I don't know if True America uses this, I'm curious to what you think about this rule of thumb in terms of pricing and cap rates. So, you know, some groups will say to me, they like to buy at a cap rate that's 150 basis points north of the 10-year treasury. And when the 10-year was at 1 or 2%, you know, you could buy at a really low cap rate. Now the 10-year is, you know, it went up to 4.25, went down to 3.5, and now is almost at 4% as we're taping here at the end of February. And that would suggest a 5.5 cap rate. Granted, each location is different. Each vintage is different. Do you guys ascribe to that rule of thumb? And if so, how are you finding deals at that cap rate?
Yeah. So my first comment is, you know, not all cap rates are equal. And I think cap rates are dynamic, not static. And, you know, two deals that are a 5 cap aren't really, could be very different type of deals. One deal could be a fully renovated, stabilized deal. Another deal could have rents that, you know, are 20% below market. And so I think, you know, part of the exercise is understanding what the real rents are at that property and what the real opportunity is. I do think a big reason why there is very little transaction volume today is because many buyers want to feel like they're having, you know, positive leverage and neutral leverage. And the reality is, where you see where cap rates are transacting at today, you got to be willing to, you know, either have neutral leverage day one, or being willing to absorb negative leverage for some period of time. And again, it's, you know, negative leverage, you're only able to get 60 to 65%, you know, LTV today. So it's, you know, some of this is a bit academic when you talk about negative leverage. But, you know, the truth is, our view is that cap rates are not necessarily correlated to interest rates. I think it's more correlated to flow of funds, and there's still plenty of equity that wants to be in multi. And I think people are, you know, buying today or buying with neutral or negative leverage because the underlying asset has growth to it. So
sure.
And I think you're buying at better value today than you were buying 9 months ago. And I candidly think that people that are buying things today that, you know, can get comfortable with what the leverage situation is you could always replace the debt on a deal. So it's hard.
Let's talk about debt. And then I want to get into the equity. Yeah. So what percentage of deals that you're looking at are loan assumptions versus new debt? And if they're new debt, are you executing with a Fannie Freddie or are you executing with a debt fund? And how has the leverage changed today versus 12 months ago? I know that's a lot that I've thrown out there, but speak about how you guys look at the debt aspect on your acquisitions.
Yeah, I mean, we've never been a high leverage borrower, so we're typically targeting, you know, 65% loan to cost on a deal. So, you know, our leverage point tends to be, you know, 60 to 75% LTV. And so, you know, we weren't those groups that were borrowing at 80%. I think today, for the type of real estate we buy, which is this, call it Class B stuff, Fannie and Freddie are the only game in town. I mean, you can get debt fund, but if you're a select sponsor like Tramerica, why would you want to take the expense of debt when you can, you know, borrow with lower spreads and lower leverage with the agencies right now?
So what is the loan to value percentages today versus what you were getting a year ago?
I think today you're probably, for us, you can get 60 to 65%. You know, a year ago, you could probably get, you know, 70% to, you know, 75 in some cases. A lot of the deals that we were doing in the first part of 2022, we were actually attempting to delever our fund a bit. And so we were doing lower leverage. We were doing lower leverage fixed rate deals in the threes. So obviously you can't borrow in the threes today, but you know, fixed rate debt is probably in the fives today for, you know, Fannie and Freddie with their 5-year product. So but you can still get, you know, 60 to 65%, you know, today with that. So
yeah. And so on the equity side, you've spoken about your fund. You've spoken about your joint venture LP relationships. I also know firsthand that you've even syndicated maybe one or a couple deals. So how do you decide to buy a deal, or how do you decide which equity structure you will utilize for a particular deal?
Yeah, well, it's actually pretty simple. The fund has first priority on acquisitions in our pipeline for the Western U.S. and the Eastern U.S. So that's, you know, so those things go to the fund. We typically do recaps, and we opened up an office in Dallas before COVID. And so the Central U.S. has kind of been a new market for us, and our fund LPs that felt like we didn't have a track record there. So that was excluded from our fund one. That's also because we haven't had any realizations in the Texas markets being excluded for fund two. So, you know, the JVs are kind of doing the center of the country. They're doing recaps and things that, you know, fall out of the fund parameters, you know, in the return profile of the fund. So.
Yeah. Are you continuing doing any syndications?
We'd like to, but it's just been hard to find things that make sense. And candidly, raising capital from, private individuals is a lot of brain damage. So it's a lot easier to, you know, get a single check, but, you know, syndications are, you know, probably more lucrative, but
sure.
We have a well-oiled machine for institutional capital. So
yeah,
it's a different business strategy but we're hoping we can do some more syndications this year. So
yeah, look, it's not for the faint of heart.
So
yeah, there are clients of mine who've also been on the show, and they've been professional syndicators from day one, and it's like riding a bike for them. And to them, the institutional joint venture world seems extremely challenging and foreign. And then there are those like you guys, where it's the institutional world, which is old hat, and it's the syndication structure that seems challenging. There isn't one that's better or worse. There are some positive aspects to one, and there are some positive aspects to the other, and there are negative aspects to each.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, it's, I'm not saying there's a right way to do it. I think people get into this business and, you know, grow their business very effective a certain way. And yeah, I think people that are private syndicators wouldn't want to have to give up the control they'd have to give up to do an institutional JV, let alone, you know, have the scrutiny you get from doing a commingled fund and the proctology exam you get from some of these state pension plans, you know, that are giving you discretionary capital. So anyways, yeah, I mean, it's a different business model. So,
yeah, but you know, it's funny, you say, I forgot the words you use, but it, you know, to rack your brain to syndicate a deal and raise money through private capital seems, I don't want to say daunting, but it's just a lot of brain damage, I think, is what you said. But yet, Noah, how many miles on an airplane and hours on an airplane have you logged, not just flying around the country, but I know you're in the Middle East and you're in Europe and maybe even Asia and other parts that I feel like you've lived your life on an airplane meeting with institutional capital. That's no easy task.
I agree. And I think that's something
this is my way of making sure that Bob hears this and gives you a nice pat on the back. No, but on a serious note, you know, you're married, you have a young daughter. How is it? Traveling sucks. It just does. And I don't travel that much. And I travel for a couple of conferences and YPO events. But you literally, I wouldn't be surprised. You probably travel, 100,000 miles a year? Easy? If not more?
Easy or more.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the business I got in here. And I'm just really good at raising money. So from big institutions. So again, when I talk about the brain damage of raising, you know, high net worth money, I mean, for us, you know, we do a lot of transaction volume here at True America. You know, we're buying, you know, $1.5 to $2 billion of real estate a year. So, you know, we have to be able to rinse and repeat very quickly. And these private syndications are, you know, raising 50, 70 investors and herding cats is a little different than, you know, getting a, you know, big ticket check for, you know, for $100 million. So,
yeah. Well, I tell everyone it's easier for me to introduce someone who's willing to write a $50 to $100 million check than to introduce you to someone who's going to write a $50,000 to $100,000 check. Yeah. It's that's just the nature of where we are transacting. All right, so let me ask you a couple questions about your statement that you're really good at raising institutional capital, because I agree you are. I mean, look at True America with $18 billion of assets. You can't do that with $50,000 check writers. You have to do that with major check writers, both on the joint venture level and on the fund level. So what does it take if someone is starting out and they want to do another True America and they want institutional capital, whether it's through a joint venture model or a fund model? What are the things that you have seen over your years that sort of resonate with these institutional investors?
Yeah. Well,
I don't want you giving up the secret sauce, but
the audience. Listen, it's not rocket science what we do. I think at the end of this day, it's a relationship business. And that's the philosophy you have to have when you approach fundraising, transacting, is being commercial friendly. And when we started this business, And, you know, I partnered with Bob Hart. In some ways, he had to kind of reprogram me. When you're building a business, you have to be willing to compromise on what the perfect partner is. And we grew our business here and agreeing probably to terms that, you know, looking back, were like, why did you agree to that? That's crazy. But by approaching institutional capital, being very willing to accommodate them, they'll want to do a lot of more business with you. And once you're able to demonstrate you can be a fiduciary for them, it kind of creates the momentum and you develop a reputation where suddenly everybody wants to do business with you. And that's kind of like how we did it here. It's like probably the first 3 or 4 years, we agreed to terms and, you know, that were probably more LP friendly. But listen, we just did a lot of business, and that's really, again, how you build a big platform is just, you know, kind of, you got to find a way to grow and fuel the fire. And I don't know if that really answered your question directly, but, you know, that was probably one of the biggest influences, impetus for us to like grow was just, I don't want to say we sold our soul, but, you know, willing to do things that probably, you know, in a market, especially that we've been in the past couple of years, people didn't have to agree to these type of terms. It was kind of a sponsor friendly world. You know, back in 2013, you know, we were just kind of coming out of the GFC and we had a new brand, True America. Nobody knew who we were. People had transacted with Bob, they transacted with me, but we had no track record. You had to be willing to, you know, be flexible on yeah, what you're willing to agree to with people. And when you make people money, they trust you, and then it just kind of, it becomes a reputation that you build and you grow on that.
Absolutely. Let's talk about those early days in 2013. I remember that office in Sherman Oaks. I remember sitting with you.
Yeah, right. Cockroaches.
Cockroaches. You're not talking about the lawyers. You're talking about
Actual real cockroaches. Yeah. Dr. Lee building. And
yeah, I remember I remember the carpeting.
Yep. And I remember we had this woman from Goldman Sachs come to our office, and Katie Bloom, she's in the real estate equity platform there. And she came to our office, and I think afterwards told Bob and I, like, if you want to raise institutional capital, you're gonna, you know, I know you're a startup, but you got to have like real office space. You can't have like cockroaches on the floor.
I don't remember the cockroaches, but I do remember the office next to or near Castle Park.
Yep.
Off of Sepulveda in Sherman Oaks. And I remember those times. I remember you and I talking about your next move. And
you as well. I mean, you.
Yeah.
Left a boutique firm to kind of start up your own practice. And I think we were kind of at a similar place. And as we got to know each other, I don't know, 15 years ago, I think we first got to know each other. And so, you know, we started different businesses and, you know, they've really kind of grown. So you can't sneeze at what you've built as well with Jeff. So.
Yeah. Look, it's been a great run for both. And I guess final question or two on those early days and how you decided to partner with Bob, and go from literally a startup to now an $18 billion company. I guess what was it about partnering with Bob during those days that made you feel comfortable that this is the path for you? And did you ever imagine that it would be what it is today?
Second question first. Never imagined in our wildest dreams that this is what it would, you know, would happen. Some of it was luck, and some of it has really been been the team here that we've assembled. Bob, I was at an inflection point in my career where I was looking to do something more interesting, and Bob was actually my professional mentor. During the GFC, when Bob was at Kennedy Wilson, I was in the same office building, 9601 in Beverly Hills. And I think in 08, 09, a lot of us investment professionals had a lot more free time. Back before it was Equinox, it was Sports Club LA. We'd actually work out. I don't think I've worked out since, that time 10 years ago. But we got to know each other. I got to know Bob in the elevator at the gym, and we started getting together for drinks, just giving me advice on my career at that point. And we had one of these fortunate nights, December of 12. I'm a voter, Bob's a voter as well. And I was down at the boat parade in Marina Del Rey. And I was on a date with, this is before I met my wife. And I see Bob there with his wife.
Wait, was it a date with someone that I introduced you to?
It was not you, but it was somebody David Mehrouni had introduced.
Okay.
I run into Bob there. I'm like, Bob, what are you doing here? And he's like, shh. He's like, we have this deal under contract right now. It was the Esprit in Marina Del Rey. And that night, he's there with his wife, he's there with his daughter, he's there with his, acquisition guy and his acquisition, Nick's girlfriend, who's now his wife. And I invite him over to my apartment in Marina Del Rey for pizza. And I think there was like a De La Hoya fight. So after the boat parade, they came over. And then Bob says, hey, I'm going to go sleep on my sailboat tonight. Why don't you and I just have a drink? And we ended up smoking Cuban cigars and polishing a bottle of Blue Label together at like 3 or 4 in the morning, just the two of us. And
was your date upset that
he left? She went home. I mean, yeah, Terry, no, she wasn't there. She she laughed and his wife left, but it was just us at this point. And that night we basically said we need to work together. He's like, listen, I'm an officer of a public company, and I can't tell you the details, but, don't make a move. Like, let's continue to talk. I got something big that I want you to be a part of. And, 6 months later, we launched Tour America. But it was that night that we were together that we kind of, forged the bond. And I'm like, this is really somebody I felt like I wanted to build a business with, and that I felt like I could get behind, and I really haven't been back since then. So,
yeah. I mean, look, the longevity that you've had in this career, but the 10 years at True America from day one, it's truly remarkable. And just speaks of the partnership that you have with Bob and the trust that you guys have for each other. And it's proven as successful as can be of any company that was formed in, the early 2010 timeframe. And I can't imagine another company that's in real estate, not a tech company, but a real estate company that's formed in that time period that now has $18 billion under management.
Yeah. Well, as Bob will tell you, this is going to be a transformative year for us. We're calling it True America 3.0. We've grown our business. We just launched a development platform. We're in the process of putting together we're calling a rescue capital business, I think, to take advantage of some dislocation that we're going to see with some I'm going to try to be very generous and nice how I think about my peers here. Some of these less experienced deal guys that kind of got into this business over the past 24 months that kind of went on their own that I think are in for a reckoning here. So, you know, we're trying to figure out how to develop our business more than being like a one trick pony, which is, you know, we've obviously done a fantastic job of that. And you know, trying to figure out how to really grow this into something bigger than what it's been. So that's kind of what our year ahead of us has for us. So
no, that's amazing. I can't wait to see the next 12 months. And I know that you guys are very nimble and are able to transact in almost any market, including one that's a little choppy like today. So it's not a Real Talk podcast unless we end with the famous lightning round. So quick answers to the next few questions. Are you up for this, Noah Hochman, co-chief investment officer, head of capital markets?
Fire away, my friend.
Okay. All right. If you were not in the real estate business, Noah, what would you be doing?
Boating or sailing.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say that. I don't know if Naomi would appreciate that profession change, unless if you were somehow able to find a load of money underneath a particular boat, but you could have fun with it.
Before I got into real estate, and this is just a little too big, I was in private equity, and I almost like became employee number like 12 or 13 for Salesforce.com in the tech year. So who knows if I would have taken that job to move to San Francisco where I'd be today, but here I am.
Wow. So. Well, we wouldn't have met each other, and we wouldn't have had that fateful week in Tel Aviv in a 200 square foot hotel room, sharing like a double bed or something.
It was magic.
It was magic. All right. Talk about
Catalina too, or is that?
Ojai. We were in Ojai and maybe Catalina.
That weekend in Catalina.
Yeah.
Anyways,
you're right.
Yeah.
I think you drugged me. So I forgot about that. But you're right. We were in Catalina. True America 2023, net buyer or net seller by the end of the year? And if you add up all the transactions,
net buyer.
Mm-hmm. I know this is going to be a harder question because each location is different, but sort of on a macro level, cap rates, how many basis points will they be the same, or will they be greater, or will they be lower by the end of this year for multifamily class B?
I will think they would be lower at the end of the year.
Lower. Interesting. Okay.
I think if interest rates go down, I think people are going to start coming back to the market. And I think, again, my view is it's about capital flows, less about needing to have the spread in interest rates. So, but I think interest rates will be lower at the end of the year. And I think that will, I think definitely, listen, I don't think they're going to be at 3, but, you know, I think by middle of next year, it wouldn't surprise me if they're, you know, kind of back to where they were, and I'll call it 17 through 19, where it was, you know, kind of 4.5 to 5. So.
A market that you either haven't transacted in, or you're underexposed in, and you want more product in a particular market, what would that be?
That's a good question. Markets that we're not active in. I mean, we always would love to buy more in Salt Lake. I think a market we'd like to get in on the West is Boise. It's just hard, you know, it's hard to find scale there.
Yeah. But, yeah. We've done some multifamilies and some student housing, and that's a great market. Do you think you'll ever buy a deal in California again?
Yes, in California, no in LA, and probably no in the Bay Area. So, but I think unless the state really screws things up, I think, you know, the redder counties or the purple counties still are a bit rational in how they're running things. So.
Well, that's a tame answer by Mr. Noah Hawkman, leader of the Libertarian Party. All right, last question. What advice would you give a 25-year-old Noah Hawkman that you now know and you wish someone would have imparted that advice onto you?
I probably would have taken more of an entrepreneurial risk and not as waited as long as I did in my 30s to kind of move to align myself with somebody like Bob. So I wish I was more entrepreneurial when I was younger. So
yeah. But a lot of it is luck and opportunity. And you were at the marina and he was at the marina and you had those
that's kind of how a lot of these things work. It's just timing and it's part of its luck. Listen, I didn't get married until I was later in life. In my mid-20s, I was probably focused on having a little more fun and less focused on being an entrepreneur. So
well, the two great relationships and of how both are very patient and tolerate Mr. Noah Hawkman, from Bob Hart to more Naomi. Let's just give Naomi more credit of putting up with you. Noah, thank you for coming on to Real Talk. You're a mensch, you're a friend, you're a client, you're just very special. And I wanted my viewers and audience to hear about your story and True America's success, and wish you nothing but success for the rest of the year and many years to come.
Andrew, thank you. Love you to death, and look forward to seeing you soon.
All right. Take care. Thank you, Noah.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. You can catch prior episodes at scholarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Thank you for your positive reviews, comments, and for sharing the show with others.